Hey everyone, welcome back to Jackie and Me. This is chapter 11, Fighting Back. I was on cloud nine. I had met the great Jackie Robinson, just as I'd hoped to. I had been to Ebbets Field, and I even was a bat boy for the Brooklyn Dodgers. To top it all off, soon I would have $1 million worth of baseball cards. It doesn't get much better than this, I thought, as I rode the subway back to Jackie Robinson's hotel. Of course, I was going to have to change my time travel plans a little. I couldn't go home right away. I would have to stay in 1947 until Thursday to get the baseball cards from the Bond bread guy. But that was okay. I knew from the last time that no matter how long I stayed in the past, I would return home and wake up in my bed the morning after I left. The New York Giants and Philadelphia Phillies were coming into town. I could bat boy for the Dodgers for a few days, get the baseball cards on Thursday morning, and then go home. By the time I reached the McAlpin Hotel, it was dark outside. Mrs. Robinson was doing the dinner dishes when I knocked on the door. Jackie was playing peekaboo with Jackie Jr., trying to get him to stop crying, but it wasn't working very well.
"Joe, we need to talk," Mrs. Robinson said seriously as I greeted them. "I tried to track down your mama. There's nobody named Stoshak in Louisville, Kentucky. We need to know your real name and where you really live."
"I can explain," I said. "My real name is Joe Stoshak. I live in Louisville, Kentucky. And I know it's hard for you to believe this, but it's the truth. I went back in time to get here. I live 50 years in the future. That's why you couldn't find my mom. She's not there yet." Mrs. Robinson looked at Jackie, then held the back of her hand against my forehead. That's what mom does when she's checking to see if I have a fever.
"Jack," she said finally, "I think we should call the police."
"Don't call the police," I begged. "I didn't do anything wrong. You expect us to believe that you traveled through time?"
"I don't expect you to believe it," I said sadly, "but it's true."
"Ease up on the boy, Ray," Jackie said. "He's a good kid."
"Can I please stay with you until Thursday?" I asked. "Then I'll go back home. Promise."
Mrs. Robinson didn't have much fight in her. It was late. She was tired. The dishes weren't done. Jackie was upset because he'd gone hitless on opening day. Jackie Jr. was upset because, well, because he was 5 months old, and babies get upset for no particular reason.
"Thursday?" Mrs. Robinson asked wearily.
"After that, you'll never see me again," I said honestly.
"Okay, you can stay," she said, putting the sheets on the couch for me. "But I don't believe a word of all that future stuff."
The Dodgers beat the Braves again the next day, 13-6. Jackie didn't get good wood on the ball. He was pressing. It was obvious. He was nervous, anxious, and swinging at bad pitches. The next two games were against the New York Giants at the Polo Grounds. The Dodgers lost both, 10-4 and 4-3. Jackie didn't help much. I was getting pretty good at being a bat boy, though. I had learned the routine, which made everything a lot easier. After one of the Giants games, I even beat Ant in the daily shoeshine race. As if things weren't tough enough for Jackie, all kinds of rumors were swirling around. I heard some whispers around the clubhouse that he wasn't as good as the players expected him to be. Some newspaper articles said he might be sent down to the minor leagues for more seasoning. The St. Louis Cardinals, led by Dixie Walker's brother Harry, were rumored to be planning a strike if Jackie took the field against them. On the Dodgers, the players were cordial toward Jackie, but certainly not friendly. Nobody invited Jackie out to dinner after a game. Nobody sat next to him or told him jokes. He didn't join in the clubhouse card games. He was alone. The first road trip of the season was coming up, and word was passed around that the Dodgers wouldn't be staying at their usual hotel in Philadelphia, the Benjamin Franklin.
Negroes weren't allowed there. The team would stay at the Warwick Hotel instead. Even at the Warwick, Jackie wouldn't be allowed to eat his meals in the main dining hall with the rest of the team. He would have to eat in his room. And Philadelphia was called the City of Brotherly Love. Then there were the threats. Part of my job was to go through fan mail, sort it, and put it in each player's locker. Nuts wrote to Jackie every day, saying they were going to kill him. Somebody wrote that Jackie would be shot if he crossed the foul line to take the field the next day. There were threats to assault Rachel and to kidnap Jackie Jr. "Don't tell Rachel," Jackie said simply as he handed me this.
"We have already got rid of several like you. One was found in river just recently."
Every time he stepped out of the dugout, Jackie looked up into the stands defiantly. It was as if he were daring somebody to take a shot at him. Jackie pretended that the pressure didn't bother him, but I could tell it did. It showed in his hitting. He was in a deep slump. I got up extra early Thursday morning. The Robinsons were still sleeping. I threw on my clothes, grabbed my dad's empty suitcase, and hopped on the subway to Brooklyn. The grocery store was closed when I arrived, but it wasn't long before Mr. Herskowitz arrived and unlocked the door. The bond truck pulled up shortly after. The delivery man hauled his bread out.
"You're here bright and early,"
he said cheerfully as he rolled his hand truck into the store. "Did you bring the bubblegum cards?" I asked anxiously.
"Yep," he replied. "Lucky I got 'em too, because my boss was about to throw him out in the incinerator."
He went back to the truck and brought out a large cardboard box. I pulled open the flaps, and there they were. Hundreds of packs, easy, of brand new, never opened, mint condition, 1947 Bond Bred Jackie Robinson baseball cards. It took my breath away. I felt my heart beating furiously, and my forehead began to sweat. This must be what it felt like to the guy who started the gold rush in California, I thought. I thanked the bond guy over and over again as I poured the packs of cards into my dad's suitcase. As he climbed back in his truck, I walked over and handed him one of the packs of cards. "You're going to think this is crazy, but save this," I told him. "Give it to your kids. Tell them to pass it on to their kids."
"Why?"
the guy asked. "You wouldn't believe me if I told you," I said.
"Okay, kid,"
he shrugged, slipping the pack into his shirt pocket as he put the truck into gear. I had over $1 million worth of cards in my suitcase. I could have taken the subway back to the Robinson's place and zapped myself back to the future with my treasure. But I was only a few blocks from Ebbets Field. The Dodgers would be hosting the Philadelphia Phillies at 2 o'clock. I decided to stash the suitcase in the back of Jackie's locker and work one last game before going home. The Phillies have always been pretty terrible. I knew that. In over 100 years, they won the World Series only once, in 1980. That's pathetic. But the Phils started the 1947 season pretty well, winning 4 of their first 6 games. They were in second place in the National League, just ahead of Brooklyn. As the Dodgers took the field in the first inning, Phillies manager Ben Chapman rose to the top of the dugout step. I saw him cup his hands around his mouth and holler,
"Hey, Nig, why don't you go back to the cotton field where you belong?"
Other teams had razzed Jackie from the bench, but no more than they razzed the other Dodgers. For the most part, they kept the N-word out of it. This was different. This was hostility coming from Chapman that went beyond the usual baseball bench jockeying. This was pure hatred. The rest of the Phillies, taking their cue from their manager, joined in.
"They're waiting for you in the jungles, black boy. Hey, snowflake, want some watermelon? We don't want you here, brownie."
Their voices could be heard clearly in the Dodger dugout. which meant they could also be heard in the stands. The umpires didn't do anything about it. The Dodger bench was like a tomb. Everyone looked embarrassed. At first base, Jackie didn't make a peep, but he looked like a teapot just before it comes to a boil. Ralph Branca was the Dodgers' starting pitcher. He was a young guy, about 21. He threw hard. Branca got the Philly leadoff batter to slap a grounder to short. Pee-wee Reese scooped up the ball and threw it to Jackie at first base in time to get the out. But the batter didn't step on the right side of first base like you're supposed to. Instead, he aimed his foot for the left side, the side where Jackie's foot touched the bag. The hitter's spikes caught Jackie above the ankle. He crumpled to the ground like he'd been shot. I was sure Jackie was hurt bad and would leave the game, but he didn't lie there. He bounced up right away. He didn't want to give the Phillies the satisfaction of knowing they'd hurt him. A bloodstain spread slowly across Jackie's white sock. The Dodger trainer came out of the dugout, but Jackie waved him away.
"What's the matter, Blackie?" yelled Ben Chapman from the Philly dugout. "Can't handle a little blood?"
"It's red," Jackie yelled back. "Just like yours." The game continued. Branca had good stuff, and the Phillies seemed powerless to hit him. The pitcher for the Phillies, Schoolboy Rowe, was just as sharp. A row of zeros crept across the scoreboard. As the innings went by, the insults coming from the Philly dugout grew nastier. Chapman and his players were shouting awful things I had never heard before and can't bring myself to repeat. In the fifth inning, a few of the Phillies got up out of their dugout, pointed their bats toward Jackie, and made machine gun noises. In the sixth inning, one of them tossed a live black cat out of the dugout and yelled, "Hey, Robinson, there's your cousin." The Dodger bench had been quiet the whole game. But after the cat was captured and removed from the field, Eddie Stanky suddenly stood up.
"Listen, you yellow-bellied cowards," he shouted. "Why don't you work on somebody who can fight back? There isn't one of you who has the guts of a louse."
It was the first time I'd heard any of the Dodgers stand up for Jackie.
"Stanky's a nig lover," one of the Phillies shouted.
After seven innings, it was still a scoreless tie. Branca and Rowe were pitching beautifully. Jackie was set to lead off the eighth inning. As the insults rained down on him from the opposing dugout, I handed him his favorite bat in the on-deck circle. "How can you take it?" I asked him. "Why don't you fight back?" "I fight back in my own way," he said. He took the bat and walked up to the plate.
"Shine my shoes after the game, Sambo," one of the Phillies yelled.
Schoolboy Rowe's first pitch was up and in, high up and far in. Jackie dove backward to avoid taking it on the skull. His bat went flying as he hit the dirt.
"Ball one," called the ump.
Jackie got up off the ground. There was fire in his eyes. He looked ferocious. He wouldn't let anyone intimidate him. He was fearless. I retrieved his bat and handed it to him.
"Charge the mound," I urged him. "Go get him."
"No," he said firmly. "That's not how I operate." It wasn't the first time I'd seen somebody throw at Jackie's head. Pitchers had been making him eat dirt on a daily basis.
"I see you've got the guts to knock me down," Jackie yelled at Schoolboy Rowe. "Do you have the guts to throw the ball over the plate?"
Jackie had told me that after throwing a beanball, 9 out of 10 pitchers will throw a curveball over the outside corner. Most hitters are so intimidated by the beanball that they're too afraid to lean over the plate and get the hittable pitch. Rowe's next pitch was a lazy curve over the outside corner. Jackie went out and got it, ripping a single up the middle that just about took Rowe's head off. As soon as Jackie reached first base, everybody in the Dodger dugout slid to the front edge of the bench. Whenever Jackie got on, you just knew he was going to try something. As Gene Hermansky stepped into the batter's box, Jackie took a lead at first base, an impossibly long lead. Roe threw over, and Jackie dove to the bag, just ahead of the tag. He sprang right up and took the same lead again, maybe even a step further. Roe glared at him. Jackie glared right back. Roe threw over to first again. And again, Jackie dove back to the bag, just ahead of the tag.
"I'm stealing on the next pitch,"
he shouted at Roe in that squeaky voice of his.
"Do anything you want. You can't stop me."
Roe did his best to concentrate on Hermansky, but he kept peeking at Jackie out of the corner of his eye. Jackie was dancing up and down the base path, daring Roe to try and pick him off. He never stood still. He would dash up the line in a full run as if he were going to steal, but then he'd stop and go back to first base. Everybody was transfixed. Even the fillies stopped heckling for the moment.
"Too chicken to throw a pitch, schoolboy?"
one of the Dodgers hollered. Roe looked exasperated. Finally, he made a hurried pitch. Jackie took off to steal second. He took short strides and didn't seem to be running all that fast, but he got down to second base quickly. It didn't matter. Roe's pitch bounced in the dirt and skipped past the catcher. Jackie saw the wild pitch. Instead of sliding and settling for the easy stolen base, he rounded second and scampered halfway to third. The ball, however, bounced off the back wall and right to the Philly catcher. He scooped it up and whipped it to third. Jackie knew he couldn't make it there. He stopped, dead in his tracks. He had gone too far, and he knew it. He was hung up in a rundown.
"We got you now, colored boy!"
The Philly pitcher, second baseman, and first baseman ran to the second base side. The catcher and shortstop ran to third base. The whole Phillies team was lined up with one goal in mind, to get Jackie. Even the outfielders ran in to help out. Everybody knows what the fielders are supposed to do in a rundown. Chase the runner back to the base and tag him there, using the fewest number of throws possible. A ball flies faster than a runner runs, so it should be a simple matter to tag him out. The Phillies chased Jackie back toward second. But as soon as they threw the ball there, he reversed direction and headed for third. They threw to third, and he reversed direction again. As the Phillies chased him, Jackie dashed back and forth as if he had an on-off switch to change directions. After five throws, the Phillies were bumping into each other. Finally, one of the Phillies dropped the ball. Jackie slid face first into third base, kicking up a cloud of dust. The Brooklyn fans went crazy. In the Philly dugout, Ben Chapman whacked a bat against the wall. Not only had Jackie humiliated his entire team, but now he represented the winning run at third with nobody out. The Phillies went back to their positions, their heads down. Schoolboy Roe was trying to keep calm, but you could tell he was fuming. He had pitched a great game, a shutout, and now he was in danger of becoming the losing pitcher.
"I'm going to steal home now," Jackie taunted. "Don't think I won't try."
He would have, too, I had no doubt. But Hermansky lined the next pitch to left for a single. Jackie slid home just ahead of the tag. Dodgers 1, Phillies 0. When the Dodgers took the field in the top of the ninth inning, the Philly bench started in on Jackie again.
"Better not touch his towels, Pee-wee. You might catch a disease."
At that comment, Pee-wee Reese left his position at shortstop. I thought he was going to march right into the Philly dugout and start throwing punches around. But he didn't. He walked over to first base, where Jackie was standing. Casually, as if he were hanging out with a buddy, he put his arm around Jackie's shoulder and chatted with him. A gasp escaped from the crowd. It didn't seem like a big deal to me, but everyone else in the ballpark was astonished. I guess they had never seen a white man treat a black man as a friend, as an equal. That's the way the game ended. Dodgers 1, Phillies 0.